Well, we should have seen it coming. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell strikes a temporary deal with Democrats to extend the debt ceiling just until the beginning of December, saving the country, at least for now, from an economic disaster that would have impacted, among many other things, the paychecks of 1.4 million members of the U.S. military and nearly 3 million government employees, and funding for pandemic mitigation efforts. But now, hardcore Republicans and the media that leads them are using words like caved and blinked about McConnell, and others are making it much worse than that.
Mitch McConnell needs to stop with this old, outdated Washington, these swamp ways of Washington. He should not lift a finger to help the socialist Democrats rob future generations blind, because that's what this bill will do. If you raise the debt ceiling, they're going to waste all of it. And they're going to steal it from our children, our grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. In other words, Mitch McConnell, tonight, you need to stop being a swamp creature. And if you want to be a conservative leader, you need to start acting like one. And if you can't do that, you really do need to step aside.
Yes, anyone who commits the grievous sin of actually working with the other side will feel tremendous heat from the base to throw in the towel. Among Republicans, they get branded with the worst label a Republican can bear in the Donald Trump era, rhino. Now, last week, I bashed the far left for trying to blow up the bipartisan infrastructure deal. I called out the progressives for attacking moderate Democrats Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema for the exact same reason. I like the infrastructure bill, not just because it helps us rebuild the country, but because it's bipartisan. Many of the progressives don't like bipartisanship and compromise because it's, quote, not enough for them. But the rest of us just want to get things done and aren't worried about which side may win or lose from accomplishments that benefit the country. This is why nothing gets done in Washington. There's this pressure from media ideologues on both sides that forces politicians to hold the line, to never give an inch. If you yield even an iota, you're called a sellout, ostracized by the base, threatened with a primary opponent. How is anyone ever supposed to compromise? In this case, Mitch McConnell is just trying to move the country forward, just a little, just for 6 weeks. There's a reason that moderate Republicans in the Senate are leaving in droves. Richard Burr, Pat Toomey, Rob Portman, Roy Blunt, they're all choosing to leave the Senate at the end of this term. Most of the Republicans vying to replace them, well, they'll come in much further to the right, the type of candidates who wouldn't be caught dead making a bipartisan deal. The far left and the far right have both turned politics into a zero-sum game. They've adopted a posture of all or nothing. And if they insist on keeping that stance, it will result in a whole lot of nothing for the rest of us. And those of us anywhere near the middle have to speak out about it. Joining us now is Jamil Jaffer, founder and director for the National Security Institute. He has also served as a top aide to former members of Congress Mike Rogers and Bob Corker, both Republican moderates, both frustrated with the gridlock in Washington. So suffice it to say, Jamil's got a lot to say on this subject. Jamil, as you can tell, this just gets me riled up. It is just feels like it just keeps getting worse, which is if you are seen as compromising with the other side, there's nothing worse for the far left and the far right.
Yeah, look, it's a huge concern, obviously. The way things get done in this country and always have gotten done is when Republicans and Democrats find a way to work together. It doesn't mean giving up your values. It doesn't mean giving up what you believe in. It means finding a path forward that makes sense for the nation. And let's be candid. Republicans have forgotten that we're fiscal conservatives. That means we don't spend our way out of every problem, right? We want to find a path forward that makes sense for this country. It doesn't mean sending our country down an economic rabbit hole by putting ourselves into a debt trap. I mean, it's just crazy to sacrifice our economic stability by defaulting on our debt. That is not something any Republican should want or go for. And you can get fiscal discipline. You don't have to sign up for the $5 trillion Democratic plan to believe that we should have both fiscal discipline and not go over the debt cliff.
And look, and the debt ceiling is one of these topics that's really hard to articulate in terms of what is the impact, because it kind of goes over time, right? It kind of gets worse as time goes on. There's initially an impact, and then if it still remains, it gets worse and worse and worse over time. And it's just not the sort of thing that many in the media want to spend the time to explain to people, okay, here's the issue, here's why it's important, here's why we need to resolve it. And by the way, and I've said this before, look, the Democrats can resolve this on their own. There is no question about that. But whoever does this needs to do it and needs to do it now. And the fact that Mitch McConnell is offering this tiny little delay is seen. Sean Hannity's head's ready to explode. He needs to step down because he's agreeing to postpone this by 6 weeks. I mean, this is insanity.
No, I agree. Look, I sympathize with this idea that spending $5 trillion on stimulus is crazy.
Right.
I think the conservatives are right about that. This is this $3.5 trillion the Democrats say they must have in social spending is not accurate. We don't need that for stimulus, and it's not going to be good for our long-term health of our nation. But believing that doesn't mean you need to send us over this cliff. And let's be clear about what it means to not raise the debt ceiling. What that means is America's going to default on its promises, right? And that may not sound like a big deal, but we do that all the time when it comes to international relations, and it's not gone well for our nation. We do that economically. Now we're talking not just a national security crisis, but an economic crisis too. Those two combined are a disaster for our nation. We cannot be the kind of nation that doesn't uphold its words. The reason why the U.S. dollar is valued around the world is we stand by the U.S. dollar. We can't allow that to happen. That would cause economic chaos. That's not good for American workers.
You worked for Mike Rogers back in 2015 when he left Congress. He wrote a piece for Politico denouncing the national conversation, quote, "Being in politics today often seems like being in the middle of the worst divorce you've ever seen. Every day, the level of pettiness and small-minded meanness in political discourse is disheartening at best. It works against our national interests at its worst. It's hard to solve big issues with small politics." That was in 2015, and I've got to believe that he thinks, and you think, it's just gotten worse since then.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for him, but I will tell you, I think the way that our politics have gotten is outrageous, right? It's become a war of words between us and them. There's no America anymore. There's just Republican, just Democrats. And by the way, what Republicans and Democrats are today, it doesn't even resemble what I remember my party being. Republicans have forgotten about fiscal discipline, right? Under President Trump, we had massive deficit spending, right? This is not what conservatives are about. And so this idea that we should return to that, we should enforce fiscal discipline and not go over a cliff, right? There's nothing wrong with that. Mitch McConnell is doing the right thing here. He's playing it smart. He's going to ensure the Democrats don't get their $3.5 trillion. He's also not going to send this country into a debt spiral that can be hugely problematic for the average American worker. But this is the right place to be for our nation. And being attacked by Sean Hannity and other friends of mine on the right, it's not the right thing to do. They ought to be lauding Mitch McConnell, not attacking him.
Because they're not focusing on policy. They're focusing on politics. And that's the problem, is if you focus on policy, as you are, you're telling us what's good for the country. And instead, they're telling us what's good for their party. And that's the problem. All right, Jamil Jaffer, this is an important conversation. I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you. We look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, Hunter Biden has become a polarizing figure. Many on the left feel sympathy for him and view him as a distraction, while many on the right cite his name whenever they want to change the subject. But there are legitimate stories to cover tonight about his art show this week and the ongoing federal investigation of him. It's coming up next. Welcome back. Hunter Biden. I just say the name, and immediately many on the left will recoil and say, why are you covering him? It's just a distraction. While some on the right cite his name anytime any wrongdoing is committed by someone they support. Well, there are legitimate and serious issues to cover about Hunter Biden. This week, he held his first art show in Los Angeles with some pieces by the self-taught artist selling for up to $500,000 per item. There are questions that should be asked here, especially when you consider that Hunter is also under a federal investigation over his finances. The DOJ is also investigating potential illegal lobbying by a consulting firm linked to the president's son. So to those on the right who say, why isn't Hunter Biden being investigated? The answer is, he is. While the White House says neither the president nor Hunter will know who buys what from the show, the whole thing kind of stinks. And many, including Obama-era ethics chief Walter Shaub, have questions.
The American people deserve the opportunity to be able to track whether or not these purchasers are getting preferential access to government.
Now, I'm concerned at the least about the perception of it, especially when there's very little opportunity for Americans to know what's really going on behind the scenes. The pop-up show was attended by 200 guests, including L.A. mayor and nominee to be ambassador to India, Eric Garcetti. The Trump-era nominee was looking for FaceTime with one of the Trump kids when they were hawking their goods. Democrats would have never let us hear the end of it. And to be clear, something comparable happened. Ivanka Trump, who actually worked in the administration, was clearly able to leverage the family name to help her get trademarks in China back in 2018. Or think about how hotel charges and real estate buys created a constant loop of stories about potentially unethical practices by the Trump family. Or think about how the mainstream media has covered South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem leaning on a state agency to approve her daughter's application to become a real estate appraiser. All legitimate stories. Yet when it comes to Hunter Biden, who again is under federal investigation, so many on the left seem prepared to look the other way and just refer to it as irrelevant or a non-story. Let's bring in Ben Schreckinger, national political correspondent for Politico. He's also the author of The Bidens: Inside the First Family's 50-Year Rise to Power. Ben, thanks very much for coming on the program. Really appreciate it. All right, let me ask you first about the art show that's going on. Knowing what you know about Hunter Biden, what should we make of this art, this newfound fascination and success, it seems, with art?
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's certainly worthy of scrutiny. You know, I did find indications in researching this book that Hunter Biden was interested in artistic expression, at least as of a few years ago. But the art market is notorious for money laundering because the price of art is so subjective. There have been concerns throughout the years, going back decades now, that Hunter Biden's business activities have provided an avenue for people to pay him who have an interest in influencing his father. And so people are absolutely right to be looking at this, to be wanting to know who's paying for this art and how much.
Yeah. Do you find that any time you talk about Hunter Biden, that there is this immediate reaction from people, depending on which side they're on, as if his name, it just seems that his name alone is this, you know, this touch point in the country for how the media ought to be covering Joe Biden?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, it really is this stark divide where critics of the Biden administration seize on Hunter Biden. There's an absolute fascination with him to the point that he's probably become iconic to half the country. To the other half of the country, to supporters of the Biden administration, they almost proactively don't want to know what's going on with Hunter Biden. They associate any questions about his activities with Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani and potential Russian disinformation. And so it is fascinating to see the really differing reactions you get when this is a story that you cover.
Yeah. Now, the Hunter Biden story obviously goes, you know, beyond his latest foray into life outside of politics. He's still the subject of at least one federal investigation into his finances and is connected to another looking into potentially illegal lobbying practices by a consulting firm with ties to Burisma, the Ukrainian energy company whose board Hunter inexplicably sat on from 2014 until 2019. Now, there is no credible evidence to suggest this impacted any action Joe Biden took as vice president. But the DOJ is looking at Hunter's taxes and investigating his personal business dealings. In December, the federal government subpoenaed numerous documents from Hunter, including information related to his dealings with Burisma and other foreign entities. According to AP, at one point, the probe, which was opened in 2018, also looked at possible money laundering offenses. Again, if Hunter's last name was Trump or McConnell or Cruz or any of those for that matter, I would think that the left-leaning media would be all over this story. So let me ask you about that. You know, do you know anything about the status of any of these investigations?
As far as we know, they're both ongoing. David Weiss was kept on from the Trump administration as the U.S. attorney in Delaware. He's still in place as far as we know, and that's an indication that these cases are ongoing because he was kept in place to oversee them specifically.
And do you find, because I find when I cover Hunter Biden, that in particular, you know, many on the right who feel that there's not enough coverage of Hunter Biden forget that he's actually under federal investigation. You know, people will say to me, you know, well, why don't they investigate Hunter Biden? And my response is, well, they are. I mean, it's a real investigation. And as you point out, they've kept this person on, you know, a la keeping John Durham on as well to investigate this particular case. It has been going on a while. I would expect we'd know something in the relatively near future, right?
Yeah, although we don't know what we don't know. It's possible there have been new developments, delays behind the scenes. It is fascinating how little coverage this has received. I think part of it may be that Delaware is a small office. It doesn't leak the way that SDNY, for example, often does. Part of it, I think, is, you know, it's worth noting that Donald Trump got impeached for pressuring the president of Ukraine to investigate the Bidens, while his own Justice Department was already investigating Hunter Biden at that point. Trump, by all appearances, had no idea. You know, it's just fascinating to look back from that perspective at the fact that this was such a theme of the 2020 election, calls for an investigation. We now know that it exists, but we still know very little about it.
You know, that's so interesting. Because you're right, that President Trump at the time was asking, in essence, Ukraine to open an investigation. And here in the United States, they already had opened an investigation, which is, you know, incredibly interesting. Let me play a piece of sound. This is Jen Psaki at the White House responding to a question about whether Hunter Biden still holds a 10% stake in a Chinese private equity firm that's controlled by the state-run Bank of China.
Again, I conveyed to you, and then I think I'm going to have to move on, that you should talk to his representatives. And there's no reason to yell. I'm certainly not yelling. You should talk to his representatives. That remains his policy. He's been working to wind that down. Beyond that, I think would talk to his representatives.
That's whose policy? I mean, that's Hunter Biden's policy? I mean, you know, that it's his policy, you have to speak to his representatives. I mean, it does seem that these are legitimate questions to ask of the White House about the first son.
That's right. And the White House has tried to distance itself time and time again from Hunter Biden, just as the campaign did. Obviously, very difficult to do when he is the president's son, and this is a famously tight-knit family. And so we don't know if he's divested that investment yet. And we also don't know about his more recent China-related ventures with CEFC, this Chinese energy company. This is the company he was going into business with, where we have this email about 10% being held by H for the big guy. One of his business partners, Tony Bobulinski, has said yes, that does refer to Hunter holding equity in this venture on behalf of his father, Joe Biden. Biden's campaign has denied having any plans to do anything like that. But Hunter Biden has never spoken about this. And so there are many unanswered questions, and the White House's position has consistently been, sorry, we don't have real answers for you, go to Hunter Biden. In my experience, I've not had luck getting Hunter Biden or his lawyer to respond to this.
Well, I have to say, the thing that I found persuasive on the Tony Bobulinski story about, you know, that reference that could have been to Joe Biden and that he said was a reference to Joe Biden, is that the Wall Street Journal did get access, did they not, to all of the documents that Tony Bobulinski said he had and spoke to him. And they determined, I believe, that they didn't think that there was enough of a story there, in essence, that they didn't feel there was a there.
Yeah, they did do some reporting on Bobulinski's claims. They found no evidence that Joe Biden actually moved to take equity, that he was involved in any plan to secretly hold equity. There's no evidence that that happened, but there are real questions and there is real evidence that Hunter Biden was talking about doing that. And so that raises the question of why was he telling people he was going to hold equity on behalf of his father, if in fact he was saying that, if his father knew nothing about it.
And I find it so interesting that, you know, there was the laptop story, right? Again, what actually the laptop means is different from what was actually in it. And it was as if, like, you couldn't report on it, you couldn't talk about it until you were the one who sort of verified that what was in the laptop was true, and then suddenly everyone's like, oh, well, Ben from Politico reported this, so now the mainstream media is allowed to discuss what was in Hunter Biden's laptop.
Yeah, you know, I think that laptop and its contents and the way that it has been received in this political and media environment is probably something that will be studied for years on end. To some people, it was totally shocking when I reported that I was able to verify parts of it, including a couple of key emails from those early New York Post reports. And to others, especially those on the right, their criticism is, you're not telling me anything I don't know. And that really speaks to this, you know, what I would call an epistemic divide in this country. People are really in two different bubbles and experiencing, you know, our political reality in two very different ways.
Well, look at this. Ben and I were able to have a conversation about Hunter Biden that wasn't drowned in politics. It was just based on the fact that there are serious questions to be asked of the president's son. That's it. Ben, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
We're making progress in this country, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, an officer tases a suspect after he's attacked. The guy falls to the ground, then pulls out a gun and shoots. We'll take you through this insane video. Time for tonight's police cam segment, where we show you the dangers police face in the field every day. We're going to see what happens when an officer in Ohio investigates a claim of counterfeit cash being used in a store. I want to warn you that some viewers may find this video hard to watch.
Where, sorry, please. Could I ask you to?
No.
Okay.
Well, what?
Because I told you to.
What happened?
Well, you passed a counterfeit dollar bill back. This guy's on line one behind England. Put your hands behind your back. This guy's having been shot. Give me a medic. I'm behind 609 Ingram. Please hurry. I've been shot on the left side of my head. I can barely hear my earpiece.
Yes, that was blood dripping from the head of Dayton police officer Thad Holloway after he was shot by Antoine Lowe, who was on the ground after Holloway tased him. The bullet ripped through Holloway's temporal artery. Another officer rushed Holloway to the hospital. He is now recovering at home after surgery. Lowe also survived. He's out of the hospital and in jail awaiting trial. Here to discuss this is retired Tulsa Police Lieutenant Sean Sticks Larkin. Again, Sticks, thanks again for coming back. We appreciate it. So we see the suspect there take a swing at Officer Holloway, who deploys his taser. The suspect falls to the ground, but still pulls out a gun and shoots the officer. Have you ever seen that happen before?
You know, I've seen plenty of people fight through what we call a taser deployment. You know, that thing is not a solve-all. It's one of the, I guess, issues I'll say that you hear from the public oftentimes, why didn't the officer just use a taser? The taser does not work all the time. It is a great tool for us, but that's exactly what it is. It is a tool. Studies vary. It typically has an effective rate about 60 to 70% of the time. Many different factors on why it doesn't always work. Everything from the clothing, how close the officer is to the suspect when deploying it, is the person under the influence of narcotics and so forth. So this one actually looks like it had, you know, a good taser deployment, which is what we call neuromuscular incapacitation. But that only lasts typically about 5 seconds. And after that, the person basically is able to start moving around freely again. He starts moving freely again and pulls a firearm out. Ideally, an officer would love to have a secondary officer present when he deploys a taser. That way, that officer can get hands-on while you're controlling the taser. He didn't have this luxury here. and unfortunately it ended in this deadly force encounter.
So the police chief there noted the comments that the officer made about staying away, meaning how he was basically trying to protect bystanders in that area.
Yeah, Dan, listen, I want to point out numerous things this officer did very well. He's having contact with a suspect of a crime by himself. Common, happens every day all over across the country. The suspect throws a punch at him. The officer immediately deploys to a less lethal item, being the taser, deploys it. Guy goes down. He's given clear commands to the suspect. Once the officer is actually shot, he immediately transitions from that taser to his firearm. That's the tool he needs to go to at this point, is his firearm. He's able to then fire rounds downrange at the suspect. He incapacitates him, calmly gets on the radio, describes exactly what's happened, where he's at, where he's been shot at, and is still aware of the citizens that are around and trying to keep them in a place of safety. Officer did an amazing job. Also wanted to point out in the full video or recording of this, you can hear a supervisor come on the radio trying to talk to the officer to keep him talking until they can get there to do what's called a load and go. They put him in the hospital. Put him in the police car to get him to the hospital.
Because as we saw in the video, the officer, you can see the blood dripping there. Really just astonishing video in there on his arm as well. All right, so the good news again is that the officer there is recovering after surgery. So that is the good news from this 8-year vet. Sean Stix Larkin, thank you so much for coming on the show. Again, we appreciate it.
As always, Dan, thank you.
Up next, it's the scandal that rocked the sports world and Hollywood. Now the Varsity Blues case, you know, the parents who paid to get their kids into college. It's actually heading to a jury. It's in their hands. Some think the prosecution has a slam dunk case. I don't know. We'll see. Coming up after this. Welcome back. If you saw me on Good Morning America this morning or heard me on my Sirius radio show today, okay, I'm self-promoting. I get it. But I promote this show a lot on radio. So you'll know that I'm fascinated by the first trial in the Varsity Blues case, the college admissions scandal. First case to go to trial is now in the hands of the jury. I'm fascinated that two dads are willing to risk it all. Prosecutors are alleging that these parents paid off this middleman, Rick Singer, to get their kids into college by pretending that they were college athletes. Up to this point, 47 parents have pled guilty, and they've received sentences ranging from probation to 9 months in prison. The median sentence is around 90 days. John Wilson and Gamal Abdulaziz are risking the possibility of many more years in prison by going to trial, where the jury just wrapped its first full day of deliberations. Wilson, a former Staples executive who now heads a Massachusetts private equity firm, is accused of paying $220,000 to have his son designated as a USC water polo recruit and an additional $1 million to buy his twin daughter's way into Harvard and Stanford. Abdulaziz, a former casino executive from Vegas, is charged with paying $300,000 to get his daughter into USC as a basketball recruit, and there's significant evidence against them, most notably phone calls recorded by Singer.
I can send him your $500,000 that you wired into my account to secure the spot for one of your girls. I asked him for a second spot in sailing, and he said he can't do that because he has to actually recruit some real sailors so that Stanford doesn't catch on.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so I know. Stanford, he's got to catch some sailors, yeah.
Yeah, so that Stanford doesn't catch on to what he's doing.
I mean, it is kind of funny. Their defense is saying that Singer effectively tricked them, lured them by assuring them this is all normal, and there's a reason. And there's a reason that prosecutors didn't call Singer to testify. They didn't. So here's my take. I'd be surprised if they were acquitted outright. But I wouldn't be surprised if the jury at least hung on some of the charges. There's a real defense despite that audio. I know, it sounds bad. I mean, this guy Singer found a way to cheat the system, convince parents it was a great way to help their kids. Problem for the defense is that I don't know that a jury is going to have a lot of sympathy for rich parents clearly trying to cheat the system in some way, shape, or form. because the trial was not on camera. I wasn't able to follow every day. So let's bring in an expert who's been following it. Joining me now is Melissa Korn, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who's been covering the trial. She's also co-author of Unacceptable Privilege, Deceit, and the Making of the College Admissions Scandal. Thanks very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it. All right, so how do you think the defense has been going so far?
So it's been definitely an uphill battle for the defense lawyers. The judge in the case denied a lot of motions where they were asking to bring in exhibits and testimony from USC officials. They say part of their defense is that these parents were kind of just playing the game the way you have to at a university like University of Southern California, where money talks. That was their argument. And the judge just said they couldn't bring this in. USC was not on trial here. So they ended up mounting a fairly short defense with just a few witnesses for John Wilson. And it went to jury deliberations this morning.
And neither of the parents testified. This guy, Rick Singer, didn't testify either. And so the key evidence becomes these audio tapes. And, you know, some of them at the least are bad. At the worst are terrible. But how did the defense deal with those tapes? I mean, when the tapes are being played, obviously their cross-examination becomes the significant part of the defense. What were they trying to achieve there?
So when the tapes were played, obviously the prosecutor was saying, listen, you have it in these guys' own words that they are engaging with Rick Singer to cheat their kids' way into school, that they were in on it, they weren't being conned. The defense says, well, if you'll notice, you know, my client only said yes or uh-huh or yeah, all right. They didn't really engage in conversation. That was for one parent. For the other parent, it was kind of, listen, he just didn't know. So he was asking these legitimate questions, and he really thought that's how the system worked. It's definitely a tough argument to make. As the prosecutor said during closing, their words are kind of the biggest thing going against them right now, whether it was in those phone calls. We had read the transcripts before, but this is the first time we had access to the audio, and just hearing it is even more jarring.
Yeah. Without talking about, you know, up to 20 years, up to this, none of that actually means anything. There's actually sort of guidelines, and lawyers have a pretty good sense. What is the sense as to the sentencing range that they might face? Pointing out that the people who've pled guilty, so far no one served more than 9 months. I mean, I've estimated that I think that if they're convicted, and one of them faces one additional charge that one of them doesn't face, but roughly I would think that you could be talking in the 3 to 8 year range in prison, but that's just a guess based on the charges, and obviously there's no answer, but have you had any sense of what the sentencing range could be?
So as you said, the kind of up to 20 years doesn't mean that much here. These are first-time white-collar defendants, right? They don't have long criminal records. The fact that the other parents who pleaded guilty got up to 9 months, and they agreed to plead quite early. They admitted their guilt, they showed contrition, all of that, and the judge usually tends to look kindly on that. The fact that these parents haven't, if they were to be convicted, would certainly be facing longer prison stints than that. But the exact amount, we're not sure. There's, you know, felony, conspiracy, fraud and bribery charges, and for another parent, aiding and abetting in fraud and bribery, and a tax charge.
Yep. And to remember that when these other parents pled, what happened was they eliminated a lot of the other charges. Part of the plea deals was you can just plead to a lesser offense and now you'll be sentenced. With the people who are deciding to go to trial, they're including all the charges that were against them. So that also increases the potential liability. Quickly on the final question, the prosecutors didn't have Rick Singer testify. The reason for that is because he probably would have been a pretty bad witness for them.
Yeah, he was not known as being a straight shooter. I think that's the general takeaway from this entire case. And he wasn't a wonderful cooperator. You know, when the feds flipped him, he withheld information. He actually tipped off some of his clients and ended up getting an obstruction of justice charge. So the fact that he is an admitted fraudster, he doesn't make the most reliable witness.
And I think that it also would have allowed the defense to raise additional questions about how Singer did what he did, which wouldn't have been helpful to prosecutors, right?
Right. I mean, the burden of proof here is beyond a reasonable doubt. And the defense attorneys did what they could to kind of plant those seeds of doubt. And having Singer on the stand definitely would have given them a lot more opportunity to do so.
So the jury has just wrapped up its first day of deliberations. I will tell all of you, from covering trials the way I have throughout my career, juries do tend to come back on Fridays because they don't like to have to work through the weekends. But if there is dissension on that jury, which again, I think there could be on certain charges, this thing could go a lot longer. So we shall see. The one thing I won't ask you to do is predict how long the jury will be out, because people ask me that all the time, and I always say to them, how the heck would I know? I'm not back there with them. So I'm not asking you that. Melissa, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Fox News gets a nice gift just in time for its 25th anniversary. New polling on President Biden, but not all cable newsies ran with it. It's coming up next. Time now for our Mediaite Moments, where we check in on the day's bias, buzz, and bull in the world of cable news and beyond. Fox News spent much of the day celebrating their 25th anniversary today, as well they should. They've been the dominant force in cable news for more than 20 years. But Christmas came early for them when new polling on President Biden came out last night.
Fox News alert, and new at 2, President Biden's support plummeting, his poll numbers hitting new lows. The president's poll numbers are in absolute free fall as his approval rating plunges to just 38%.
Look at the latest Quinnipiac poll. Biden's approval rating in the sewer.
President Biden's standing with Americans is sinking. And fast.
Parents, there's a reason his approval ratings are so low. It's because he is failing at everything.
It has been a nonstop refrain on Fox all day. But if you look at CNN and MSNBC, it barely got mentioned. And when it did, well,
the president's domestic agenda is still in jeopardy, and his approval rating is hitting a new low, 38% in a Quinnipiac poll, 45% in CNN's poll of polls.
The Quinnipiac poll is an outlier.
Yeah, it's an outlier. Maybe true, but over at MSNBC, there was just one mention of it, and it was from a guest.
But this comes just at the right moment for President Biden, who is really getting hammered. You look at his job approval rating in the new Quinnipiac poll out today, 38%. That is dismal news for a president.
That it is. But back to Fox News, where they've been all over Biden's low poll numbers. But, you know, when President Trump suffered the same low poll numbers in these same polls, they just weren't very reliable.
Forget about the national polls. It's all about the battlegrounds anyway. Most pollsters are undersampling Republicans as high as 10 points. They do that just to depress turnout. Don't fall for it.
Right. That's our wrap-up of the day's media bias, buzz, and the bull, our Mediaite Moments. And that does it for us tonight. News Nation Prime starts right now.